see what you knew about the tumors. I had no idea they were going to kill your family. Once they did, there was no turning back the clock. I'm sorry how it went down, bro, but this is bigger than you or me. So you kept it from me and then used me to kill off everyone who knew about the experiments. SecDef gets elected, the Domestic Safety Act gets passed, and you all make your fortunes from RD-4895. Everybody has a price, bro. Apparently mine has 10 figures. Reese stared at his best friend in a disgusted rage. That's why you never gave me any location information on this guy? Reese asked, gesturing toward Horn. You needed him to keep this plan moving forward. You needed him in place for your payday. You were always the smart one, Reese. And yeah, that was why you weren't killed at the condo. You were being so efficient tying up our loose ends while at the same time increasing our share of the profits that the logical business decision was to allow you to keep at it. Up until now, that is. I was actually nervous you would put it together quicker than you did. Those emotions got to you, bro. Kept you from seeing the whole picture. And J.D. Hartley? Reese asked, looking at the SecDef. Not able to even form a sentence, Lorraine Hartley looked in loathing at Steve Horn. Don't act surprised, Lorraine, Horn said in partial dismissal. His death helps propel you into the White House with the sympathy vote. You haven't spent the night in the same house in years. He was a liability to your campaign as it was. Don't pretend like you are going to miss him.
You concocted a plan to let Reese keep killing our business partners and didn't inform me?
The SecDef asked Horn in shock.
As much as I'd like to take credit for that part of the plan, I can't. It was all Ben's idea. Following your jihadi's failure to take him out on the streets of L.A., Ben went a bit further off the reservation and devised a plan that allowed Reese to continue his crusade, making us all richer in the process. When he finally read me in after Reese killed Holder, Tedesco, and Pilsner, I thought it was genius. Can't believe I didn't think of it myself.
Secretary Hartley shook her head in disbelief as Horn continued.
Ben's actually a lot smarter than he looks. Don't be fooled by the tattoos. He's been right about a lot of things, including the fact that Reese would make it past my contractors and into this very room. Hence, our insurance policy tied up on the floor there, he said, pointing at Katie. Your friend had more faith in your skills than I did, Mr. Reese. Well-founded, it now seems.
Here's what's going to happen, bro, Ben said. Horn is going to make us all very rich. Almost everyone else who stood to profit from this is dead, thanks to you. Yeah, you will have to do a little time, but the SecDef will pardon you with her newfound presidential powers, blaming your actions on the ravages of PTSD. I am going to disappear, never to be heard from again, and you and Katie can live happily ever after. Maybe they can even operate on that tumor of yours and save your life.
Ben looked at Katie, her eyes wide with a mixture of revulsion and horror.
Oh, and Katie is just here to ensure you make the right decision. I'm sorry about your family, Reese, I really am. Nothing can bring them back now. Let's all do the smart thing. The pardon is a gift. Katie's life is a gift. Don't fuck this up, bro.
Reese looked at Katie, then back to Ben, his eyes the picture of resolve. Horn broke the silence with a loud, slow clap, pulling himself out of his chair to take a more domineering position above the other conspirators.
Ben, that was a lovely breakdown of the plan, thank you, but I've had a change of heart. I am modifying the terms of the deal. Our negotiating power has shifted. Let's clean this mess up right now, shall we?
What do you mean, Horn?
Asked Ben skeptically.
Tonight, Commander, Horn said, turning his attention to Reese as if presenting an investment opportunity to a client. You get to actually save a life instead of taking one. You get to save Katie. You get to save her by dying.
Reese hadn't dropped the M4, but he did shift it toward Horn, the SecDef tensing up as the barrel passed across her face.
"Come on, Reese," Horn said in an almost bored, exasperated tone. "You are not leaving here alive. You are half dead now from that tumor, if I understand correctly. If you kill any of us, Ben lets go of that button and you kill the one friend you have left, who seems to be quite fond of you, by the way. Shoot yourself or let us shoot you. It matters not either way. Point being, you keep Katie alive, and we all move on with our lives." Horn never finished his sentence. The explosion from the charge in the driveway split the SUV in half, turning the Capstone security men into human mulch. The blast shattered the multitude of windows on the mansion's front and sent a shockwave through every room. Reese's first bullet caught Horn between his nose and mouth, forever leaving him with a look of surprise on what was left of his face. He was dead before he hit the ground.
"No!"
screamed the SecDef, crawling up onto her chair, covering her ears with her hands. Reese's next two rounds found their way into her upper chest. A third to her head completed the job. Reese settled back on Ben.
"What the fuck, Reese?"
exclaimed Ben in amazement, holding up the detonator.
"What the—"
Reese's M4 finished the night's deadly business, firing two 77-grain Black Hills 5.56 rounds at 2,340 feet per second directly into Ben Edwards's face at 10 feet. His head snapped back, emptying its contents onto the chair behind him, and his hand came off the button. Katie screamed through the bandana that stifled her cries, but surprisingly, her head stayed intact. Reese stepped forward and fired two more rounds into Ben's face, then slung his weapon and knelt down to help Katie. He cut the bandana off her head before slicing the zip tie that held her hands behind her back. Falling forward into him, Katie sobbed uncontrollably.
"It's all right, Katie. It's all right,"
Reese repeated, stroking her hair and holding her tight to him.
"We have to go, Katie. We don't have much time. We have to go."
"Can you walk?" he asked, helping her to her feet and replacing his magazine with a fresh one from his chest rig.
"Yes, I can walk."
"Okay, follow me."
Reese led Katie outside, finding the shed he had identified on satellite imagery. Next to the shed was an old 17-foot Boston Whaler Montauk on a trailer. Gas cans were set between the boat and the shed. Reese picked up the first one, empty. Then he picked up the second one and shook it. Plenty of gas. He handed it to Katie and picked up another. Full.
"Follow me,"
Reese ordered again, already moving back to the house.
"Pour that gas around the room. Furniture, drapes, anything that will burn."
Katie did as requested. It felt good to take action against these monsters who had grabbed her in the dead of night from her brother's home. Reese doused the bodies with gas and then told Katie to run to the door. Looking down at the symbol on his father's old Zippo, Reese slid his thumb over the striker, grinding sparks off the flint and igniting the fuel to produce a flame. Tossing it onto Ben Edwards's body, Reese followed close behind. It was still raining when they hit the street, the summer home beginning to flame up behind them and the SUV smoldering in the driveway.
"Airfield is 4 miles west. Can you run that far?"
"Yes, but why don't we take this?"
Katie asked, pointing to an exquisitely restored 1973 two-tone forest green and alpine white Toyota FJ55 Land Cruiser parked next to the shed. Residents of Fisher's Island loved their classic cars. Reese couldn't suppress his grin, then looked back at the flaming house.
"I think I just melted the keys."
Katie smiled, opened the driver's side door, and pulled a set from the ignition.
"It's a Fisher's Island thing," she said.
"Well, that's working smarter. Let's go."
Reese took the wheel and Katie squeezed in beside him. They were on the road before the volunteer fire department had their boots on. Chapter 75. Reese looked at the luminous dials on his watch. Liz would be landing in 6 minutes. This was cutting it close. Her instructions were to wait for 30 minutes and then take off. If he didn't show up, she was to assume he was dead. By the time they made the 4-mile drive, Liz had already taxied to the north end of the runway, spun the plane around, and began readying for takeoff. Reese ditched the truck and moved Katie to the waiting aircraft, the door folded downward.
"Who is this?"
Liz shouted from the cabin door past the hot exhaust of the outtake.
"Liz, this is Katie. Katie, Liz."
"Well, get in and let's get out of here," Liz shot back.
"I'm not coming, Liz. I'm taking the secondary extraction. This is going to be a mess. I am not bringing you two down with me."
"Get in the fucking plane, James,"
Liz ordered impatiently. Reese ignored her and turned to Katie.
"Take this,"
he said, pressing a mini cassette recorder and thumb drive into her hand.
"These are the only copies. Everything those bastards said in there is on the cassette, along with some other admissions from Saul Agnan. The thumb drive has all the emails and intel that Ben gave me to help back things up. That should keep you busy for a while. Somebody has to set the record straight for my men and my family. You might even get another journalism award out of it." He smiled.
"Where are you going, James?"
Katie asked, with tears beginning to stream from her eyes.
"I'm going to die, Katie. They killed me before I even left on that last deployment to Afghanistan. They killed all my guys before we even left. It's my turn now."
He ushered her up the steps. She was too shocked to say anything. Liz just glared at him with eyes that shot fire.
"Get in the plane, James,"
she tried again.
"I love you, Liz. Now get out of here."
As Reese stepped back to close the door, Katie turned sharply in her seat, snapping out of her trance.
"Reese, how did you know Ben didn't have that detonator connected? How did you know he wouldn't blow my head off?"
Reese paused, looked Katie in the eye, and over the sound of the wind, the propeller, and the rain, replied,
"I didn't,"
before shutting the door and moving off at a run toward the marina. Epilogue. Atlantic Ocean, present day. Reese awoke below deck, the sound of the Beneteau Oceanus 48 cutting through the water and the flapping of the sails waking him from his 30-minute catnap. After throwing his feet out of his bunk, he made his way topside and into the light. The storm that had kept him busy for the first 3 days after departing Fisher's Island had subsided, leaving beautiful rolling seas and steady winds. Rafe's sister, Victoria, had sailed the Beneteau from their Martha's Vineyard home down to Fisher's Island the day before Reese's assault, removing all the electronics per Reese's request. He had also instructed Rafe to report it stolen, but somehow doubted he would. That Victoria could handle the massive 48-foot sailboat on her own spoke volumes about her competence and seamanship. Reese was struggling to just keep the boat headed in the right direction. He had sailed as a kid, though nothing this large and complex. Luckily, the Navy had seen fit to send him to a civilian sailing school years ago. The idea was that he would have the ability to rent sailboats around the world and use them to conduct surveillance or to blend in with local maritime traffic and insert seals into denied areas. He didn't know how much longer he had to live. He doubted if he would make it to Europe or Africa before the tumor killed him. He was at peace, and he was ready to leave the world behind. He thought about Lucy and cried for her, for the life she would never have. And he thought about Lauren and the second child they would never bring into the world. He was ready to join them. One beautiful sunset turned into another stunning sunrise, and Reese continued to sail. Victoria had seen to it that the boat was filled with provisions for a long voyage, water, food, and medical supplies. What would he do if he were still alive when he reached the old world or the dark continent? Turn south and continue sailing until the tumor took him? Maybe he would go for a swim and never surface? Maybe that would deliver him to Lauren and Lucy? He knew he wasn't long for this world, so he might as well continue sailing until the sea or the tumor decided it was his time. Either way, his work on Earth was done. Sitting on deck, at the starboard helm steering station, the storm a distant memory and with the blaze orange sun setting behind him to the west, Reese reached into his pocket and removed a Ziploc bag. Pausing, he slowly opened it and unfolded the paper within, drawing lines through the last of the names on his list. Josh Holder, Marcus Boykin, Saul Agnan, Steve Horn,
CJNG, Mexico,
Admiral Gerald Pilsner, Mike Tedesco, J.D. Hartley, Lorraine Hartley, Leonard Howard, Hamadi Ismail Massoud, Ben Edwards. He looked at the list without a hint of remorse. It was done. Then, hesitating briefly, he turned it over and smiled, running his fingers over the crayon drawings of his beautiful wife and daughter under an arching rainbow, the perfect splendor of which only the young and innocent can capture. His eyes glistened over and a tear fell onto his most treasured possession.
"I'm coming, baby girl,"
Rhys whispered, rubbing his eyes.
"I'll be with you soon. I love you."
With that, he moved to the stern, and watching the sun drop below the horizon, he touched the paper to his heart and let it fall from his grasp, committing it forever to the peace and tranquility of the sea. FBI Headquarters, Washington, D.C. In the days following the revelation that Secretary of Defense Hartley and financier Steve Horn had been found shot to death and incinerated along with an unidentified body in a Fisher's Island mansion, on the heels of Congressman J.D. Hartley's targeted assassination in Soho, the conspiracy theorists went into overdrive, cluttering the internet and airways with one explanation after another. Congress appointed a special prosecutor to investigate and make sense of the mess because so many government officials were involved, all of them dead, thanks to one Lieutenant Commander James Rhys, current whereabouts unknown. Things really got interesting when investigative journalist Katie Buranek published the first in a series of scathing stories exposing a conspiracy involving illegal testing of drugs on the nation's most elite special operators, the sharing of top-secret NSA-gathered intelligence information with certain individuals in the financial industry to assist in the assassination of innocent civilians, and a program of intentional radicalization of jihadi assets by elements of the U.S. government for domestic terrorist operations, leading all the way to the SecDef herself. Ms. Buranek was uncooperative in assisting investigators to unravel the story, instead telling them to wait for her next exposé. Among the piles of evidence collected by the special prosecutor was a cell phone belonging to James Rhys of Coronado, California. Having not been used in the preceding weeks that Rhys was on the move, it sat untouched on the dresser of his California home until it was subsequently collected by investigators. Later, after it had been tagged, exploited, and stored into evidence, a call had come in and gone to voicemail. Head and Spine Associates, La Jolla, California.
Hello, Mr. Rhys, this is Dr. German. We've been trying to get in touch with you. We usually don't leave messages like this, but I wanted you to hear this as soon as possible. Your biopsy came back, and under the circumstances, it is the best news that we could expect. Your tumor is what's called a cerebral convexity meningioma, which is a very common and slow-growing lesion. Based on the type and location of the mass, I am very confident that I can remove it surgically. We are talking a 75% or better survival rate. It could be causing you headaches, which is nothing to be alarmed about. Please call us back and my assistant will schedule you an appointment for a follow-up. We can speak in more detail at my office. Again, sorry to have to leave this on your voicemail, but I didn't want you to worry needlessly. Have a great day and enjoy your new lease on life, Commander.
The Terminal List, a thriller, was written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Terminal List, a thriller, is available in print from Emily Bessler Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.